G'day guys, Jay here with another episode of Pesty Profiles, the podcast where we put the spotlight on the best in the best business. And joining me once again with our part two series of bees is none other than Ben Moore from Ben's Bees. How are you, Ben?
Hey Jay, how you doing? I'm awesome.
I'm good, mate. I'm absolutely sensational.
Oh, that's good. Good to hear. I hear you're down in Vic, and I was up in the beautiful sunny coast.
How is that? I mean, yeah, Easter weekend, I shoot down in Victoria, and you shoot up here to sunny coast in Noosa.
How funny is that? Isn't that funny? What a funny time that was. But I'll tell you what, you're living the dream, Jay. That's for sure. It's awesome up there.
It's a terrible place to live and work, mate. Horrible, horrible. We don't want any more of you southerners up here.
Us Mexicans.
It's getting too busy as it is.
And that's one thing, because I used to live up there. I was 17 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I wish I had bought some property back then. But anyway.
Hindsight, mate. Tell me about
hindsight,
it.
Hindsight, exactly. I know. But so living up there was awesome. But it's just seen the growth of it. And, you know, these fooderies and cafes and breweries and distilleries. It's amazing. Awesome.
Yeah. No, it's really growing up here. Really growing.
Good part of the world. Absolutely.
Anyway, I had some absolutely awesome feedback about our last podcast.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. So I had one of our listeners actually tell me that hands down, by far, the best podcast of ours that she's actually listened to. And now she actually wants to go out and get her own hive of bees in her own backyard.
Oh, that is awesome. Now, if you can see me now, I'm blushing, Jay.
It's good, isn't it? How good is that?
That's good. That's awesome feedback.
Yeah. So last episode we spoke a little bit about you. We spoke about a lot of actual topics. Actually, we covered conferences. We covered Manuka honey. We covered a lot of things. But we started to delve into swarming, and that was the emphasis of the actual episode, in particular bees. So let me just recap, and correct me if I'm wrong. So basically, just to recap. So essentially, about springtime, the old queen will actually swarm and take approximately 50% or a third of the actual colony with her.
Spot on.
Correct. And then they basically fly off to start off a new colony. Now, I've got a question. Now, one thing you stated in the previous episode is that the queens can live up to 7 years, but you also said that typically once they've set themselves up in a new potential hive, right, they'll actually kill the old queen off.
Correct.
So how do you know she actually lives 7 years if they kill her off every time? Or is that because...
Interesting question, Jay. So they can live up to 7 years.
Yeah.
But what happens is the queen, she retains, when she mates with multiple drones, she retains all the sperm from those drones. So what happens is then the older she gets, she loses that viability. So that's why the bees, not always, but quite often or not, they actually supersede her, because to have a young, vigorous queen is far more beneficial for that colony than to have an old girl that's sort of starting to taper off.
Yeah, and mine's going with this, don't you? All right, we won't go there. So how do they work out that she lasts 7 years? Is that because they've sort of basically kept killing off the new queen so that the old queen stays active?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of actually research into bees, and bees, I think, one of the most studied animals after humans. Yeah. So they're really – so a lot of study goes into them on many different things, but one of the studies is, they will live up to 7 years.
Okay. All right. I've got a couple of questions. How far do they typically swarm?
Okay, and this is a really funny one. That's a good question, because what happens is when they first swarm, so usually for us in Melbourne, it's around 11 a.m. to about 3 p.m. So that's sort of peak. Yeah, it's pretty precise. You get that flush at 11 o'clock in the morning, and then 3 in the afternoon is popular.
Yep.
But what happens is they swarm. So all the bees come rushing out of the hive, and they will fly around, and they'll land pretty close to where the hive is. And it's usually, often or not, hanging off a branch, most of the time anywhere from 1 to sort of 4 meters off the ground from that parent colony. They'll create that ball, that cluster that we're all sort of familiar with, and then they'll sit there for a duration of time. So now that duration of time, obviously, depending on the weather, it's usually about, from my experience, about 2 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, so I know if someone says to me, okay, I've got a swarm, and they've called me at 11 o'clock, and they're and it takes me 2 hours to get there because I've got other jobs in the middle. Sometimes I'm thinking, oh, I might not get there in time.
Yeah, you're gonna miss it.
I'll take off. Yeah, exactly, miss it. But another funny thing is, I should mention as well, and this happens all the time. It's actually kind of funny, right? When I see a cluster of bees somewhere, sometimes you have a look over the fence, and it might be the neighbours keeping bees. And yeah, believe it or not, those people don't even know. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, and that's something someone's always told me, is that, you know, most swarms develop or arise from unmanaged beehives.
Yeah, correct, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Is there certain weather conditions that actually when they will swarm?
Yeah.
Temperatures, wind, anything like that?
Yeah, so actually that's another brilliant question, because when it's a slightly breezy, the bees always will swarm and hang down low. But if you get one of those spring days, say, you know, October the 17th, and it's 24 degrees,
yep,
and it's absolutely still, and the sun's up in the air, yes, absolutely, they'll actually go higher up.
Okay.
So they can go 4 or 5, you know, on rare occasions, 6 meters high.
Okay.
But usually they stay down. But they like that, just that nice sunny weather. They won't swarm when it's raining.
Yep.
So they won't, if it's got some slight drizzle raining, it's not impossible, but highly unlikely they'll swarm when it's raining.
Yeah, okay. All right. So did we answer that question where, you know, how far will they typically, so once they leave the actual hive,
oh, yes,
and they'll sit, yes, up for, like you said, for 2 hours somewhere close to the actual hive within a, you know, a couple of 100 meters, how far will they typically try and venture before they actually set up camp?
Yeah, so they'll go for around about 250 meters to about up to a kilometer.
Okay.
But it's the reason in sort of suburban areas, it's usually a lot closer, because they know, you know, that we're swarmed from the parent colony, and they want to get as far away as sort of possible, because obviously they're out competing. You know what I mean? If they're all, yeah, just swarmed. Yeah, really. Yeah, that's close.
Definitely a lot closer than I thought it was. I always thought it was going to be like, you know, 5 kilometers or something.
Yeah, no, they won't. They can move sort of in a country, sort of, you know, if you're in the Mallee of Victoria or something. Yeah, they will go a really sort of a long distance, because they know obviously there's flowers and they want to get as far away so they're not out competing with one another. Yeah. But usually, and the reason how I sort of kind of know that, because I know the areas where people keep bees. And I go, oh, you know what I mean? So there might be, say, a hobbyist beekeeper is pretty advanced. He's got like a dozen hives, or, you know, and it might have an area. And I go, okay, and there's been swarms. I go, oh, that's interesting. That's near. That might be his bees.
So you rock up in his door and say, I got your bees back.
Yes, yeah. I actually had that happen. I've parked my van in a driveway, and it was the neighbours. They would come out and go, oh, bees, because obviously I kind of stand out a little bit.
Yep.
And it actually turned out to be his bees. So interesting conversation, that one. I'll never forget that. Yeah.
All right. So now, how do they actually locate a suitable site? I know we spoke last time about they line a, you know, a void or a cavity that's, you know, approximately 20 litres in volume. How do they find that potential site? I mean, is it the queen, as she's flying, she's scanning around going, oh, there we go, or is the workers have actually scouted out previously and found a suitable location? Is it visually, or is it just purely random? They just simply land on a, you know, a void, on a wall, and just sort of find any sort of entrance, and then they spew into it? How's that?
No, how's it work? So what they do, so every bee has got a job to do. When they swarm and say they're, you know, they're in that cluster, what they'll do, Jay, is actually send out scouts.
Okay.
Now, depending, yeah, so they're actually that literally scout bees. And what they do is they'll find, let's say there's a cavity, let's say there's in the eave of a roof, we're going to paint that picture for the listeners, eave of a roof, there's some bricks. And what they'll do, you can have, depending on the size of that primary swarm, but what they'll do is I will actually send out scouts, and depending how big, you know, that colony is, so it might be 20 scouts, 50 scouts, or 100 scouts. So they could have that many. And what they'll do is they will do the measurements. So they go really sort of height and sort of activity and bouncing around and doing the measurements. And it literally is they're measuring it all up to know how good this particular cavity is going to be.
Yeah, okay, and that's something that sort of, I guess, coincides with something that I've noticed, that when a swarm first moves into a wall void, you literally have bees spewing out a downlight, spewing out a little, you know, gap crevice internally, and you find clients come home and, you know, suddenly there's bees all in their bedroom, but then all of a sudden it just stops. But then you'll I get called to the job, and then you listen to the wall and you can hear them in the wall. It's like they're actually exploring that void, the limitations of that void, and then are they attracted to the light as a potential opening until they sort of work out, I guess, the layout of that void that they've settled into?
Yeah, exactly. So once those scouts have worked it all out and they've gone, okay, this is the right spot, they go back to headquarters,
yep.
So back to that swarm, and they let them know, they relay the messages and to say, all right, girls, we've found a spot. Let's, hightail, and we've got to go, 37 meters from, obviously using the sun as the axis, and okay, we find that spot. Yeah, and actually we'll put like a pheromone signature almost into it in that cavity.
Yeah.
And they all go, and when they rush in, it's cool to see, actually.
Yeah, it's like liquid. You just see them sort of all
liquid,
just
– yes.
It just sort of all flows or spews into it and then just disappears. Like I've seen it firsthand, and I've had plenty of clients actually describe it to me, how there's literally like, a couple of thousand bees land on – a few thousand bees actually land on the wall, and the wall was just black, and then all of a sudden it just disappears, and there's just a handful of bees left over.
Exactly, and they go quiet, and that's when the property owner or whoever observed those bees may not have seen that actual swarm move in.
Yep.
But they're going, oh no, they'll disappear and go away.
Yeah, I know. I've been called out multiple times where they go, I've got a bee swarm here. Then you get there, and then there's just nothing apart from, a couple of bees. And they go, oh, they were here, half an hour ago. I don't know where they're all gone. And then, in my earlier days, I used to go, oh, okay, they must have moved on. And then I've left. And then, sure enough, a day later, 2 days later, I get a call, nah, they're back again. And then, soon worked out that, no, they're not back again. They just were sort of laying doggo initially.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah, sort of settling in initially.
That's right. And how to tell if they have moved in.
Okay.
And cool. they'll usually do this. Yeah, this is usually pretty quickly. You'll have maybe one or two bees that will go foraging. And if they come back with pollen on their legs, then they've moved in.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Because you notice sometimes when a swarm's been somewhere, there's always a few straggler drones hanging around.
Yes, sometimes they get left behind they're a bit slow, the old boys.
Well, I've just put it down to they can smell the pheromones of that queen, and so they're just sort of laying around, sitting around going, oh, I can smell her, where is she?
can't see her.
cool. The other thing I've really, really noticed with swarms is that they are so docile.
Yes, and it's like so the biggest primary reason why they're docile most of the time, and I'll explain, sometimes they can be feral, and I've been caught out, been hammered by this, by bees, is they're...
So hammered why they're swarming?
So when they swarm, not when they're swarming, but so what happens is so they engorge themselves with honey, they fill their little tummies with honey, and then obviously they all take off and go find a spot. Now they need that honey as a carbohydrate energy source to actually set up a new home. Now that actually gets converted into wax, because that wax obviously is going to produce obviously the next generation of bees.
Yep.
So the queen can lay eggs in there, obviously store their pollen and their nectar. But they've really only got 10 days to actually set up a camp and find a spot. Now, I never forget this. This is absolutely a hilarious story. I even remember the suburb. It was East Hawthorne. Get called for a swarm. It was just near a block of apartments. It was head height in one of those. I think it was like, let's say, some bushes, Poinciana bush, I think it's called. And here's me. I could cop a few stings. It's all part of the game. No protective clothing. Grab me box. And I shake him into the box. And I tell you what, I got properly hammered, right, in my face, in my neck. But what was sort of difficult is I had a bunch of people watching me. so I had to, I had to be cool and calm. I put that box down. I had to walk to my car. While I'm walking to my car, I'm just casually, right, I could feel the pain, bee stings hurt. I'm flicking these stings out of me neck, me face, me hands, and I go grab me jacket, me beekeeping jacket, and put it on and walk back. And it was like, when that happened, it was like, okay, I went too cocky. I was too showing off. I had a bit of a crowd going on. Now, the reason why is they got hungry. So sometimes a swarm can be nasty because they've used up all their stores in their stomach. They've engorged the honey from the parent colony before they've left. There's no weather conditions. They haven't found a spot, and they get hungry, and then they get angry.
They get hangry.
Hangry, that's right. Spot on.
Hangry.
Yeah. Hangry, that's right. And it does happen. So sometimes they can have a swarm. So we are talking for Australia. Variables there. If we go overseas, we've got Africanized bees, which are different genetics. So they're just nasty, just full stop. But yeah, so you can get caught out sometimes. And I never forget that.
So how do you – can you pick it before you sort of get too close to them?
Yeah, you can. And so what I do now, because I sort of went rushing in and, you know, a little bit gung-ho, what I do now, if I'm going to go, you know, and I don't recommend this to anyone, but as I said, I cop a lot of stings,
yep.
which is fine. But, you know, too many, it starts to feel, if I get cop, and now it's going to sound exaggerating to the listeners, but if I sort of cop that over 30 on one arm,
yep.
it starts to feel like sort of bad sunburn.
Yep.
It's kind of, and that's, I'm not over exaggerating that. When they get their personalities, what you can sort of tell. And what I do now is, so I go up to them and I stroke. This is gonna sound weird. Everyone's gonna go, boy, this bee guy, he's off his head. Actually like pat him like a puppy or a kitten or a dog.
Yeah, I've seen that on YouTube multiple times, and I've done it a couple of times, but I'm always just a little bit hesitant.
Yes.
How they're going to take this? How they're going to receive this?
So, but what they do is when you pat them, what happens is if they're a little bit pissy, right, they'll stick their bums up in the air, and then little stings will hang out. Yeah, so then I know. Okay, all right, they're sort of alert. They become alert and like, okay, what's going on? If they're a little bit agitated, and then I'll just, you know, go get a veil or a new jacket or suit, and then they put them in a box. But sometimes they can be like literally, I know it seems crazy, but like puppies.
Yeah.
You can pick them up and they're just incredible.
Yeah, well, you see all these YouTube videos or videos on Facebook, the bee whisperers, and, you know, there's one particular girl I know I've watched that she never or doesn't wear a suit or anything like that. And she just goes up and just scoops them all into into the box. And I'm thinking, surely you're going to come across one that's just going to be really aggro and nail you. How does she know prior to doing that what she can and can't do with them or push limits?
That's right. Yeah, it's that testing. You sort of see, and I suppose like many, many things, once you become used to it, you do recognize, you know, behavioral characteristics with them. So her name's Erica. She's the, what's her name? Her handle, Texas Bee Lady.
Yeah.
And she's awesome. She's really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so speaking of temperaments then, is there any, like, methods, strategies, approaches, things that we can do to minimize that aggression when we're working with bees, even not just swarms, but even when they've actually established themselves in an actual, a hive or a cavity? I know one thing I learned very early on the piece is do not block their flight path. If you're going to approach them, always approach side on. Just do not get in front of their flight path, because that's when you're going to get smacked in the back of the head.
Exactly. Exactly. And that can even be an accidental sting, even if you've got like a calm genetics.
Yeah.
They can actually, you know, if one lands on you, the natural instinct is to swat it.
Yeah.
You know, it's humans. So, but they can actually get accidental stings. But in regards to their temperament, now obviously I'm pretty generalizing here, but those nice, you know, those bees, they've got those nice golden orange abdomens, and it's very distinct.
Yeah.
Sort of the night. Yeah. They're what we call the Italian strain.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
The Italians are the lighter ones, are they?
Yeah. Lighter. Thought, that's right.
I thought it was the opposite way around. I always thought the Italians were the darker ones.
Nah, the darker ones are more your Germanic type sort of.
Caucasian?
The Caucasians are actually, they're jet black. So the actual queen is jet black.
Okay.
And they're, you can get variants of that Caucasian. So Apis mellifera caucus is, they actually can have, very minimal stripes.
Yeah.
And they've got these really sort of, you know, dark black abdomens. They're friendly. They're good. So yeah. There's the genetics here, but there's another one, which is the Carnolian, and they can be feisty. They're feisty. So they're once again a darker one with a very distinct banding. Now, you do get hybridization
I was going to ask that. Yeah, is there hybridization, like, you know?
Yeah, exactly. There is. And I've actually just I've just recently found out they have issues up in Cairns and Townsville where the Asian honeybee, where there's some feral colonies,
They're really light, distinctively banded, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right, and smaller.
Yeah,
exactly. But the Asian honeybee drones are mating with the European honeybee queens, and they're not getting viability. So what's happening is it's kind of like a mule, so they're actually having issues up there. So I only recently learned that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Interesting. All right, so going back to the strains, and this is what I really want to get into, actually, and I find this fascinating. How many different strains have we got? You mentioned Italians, I mentioned Caucasians, and you mentioned, what was the other one?
Okay, so we've got the Caucasians,
yep.
Carnolian.
Carnolian. Where's that from?
Oh, that's your more Germanic sort of, call it Eastern European type B.
Okay.
Now, what makes them actually really good, they build up a little bit slower than the Italians, and this is actually kind of funny. So with your sort of darker, sort of Germanic type bees, they'll work when it's colder.
Okay, yep. For obvious reasons, darker.
Yes. They work when it's colder, so sometimes even 10, 12 degrees, they'll fly out. But with the Italians, they like it warm and toasty.
Yep.
Right? But what happens is the Italians are generally calmer, but the Italian subspecies will steal honey from other hives.
Okay.
which is a problem in itself because
so the Italians are thieves. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yes. It's funny.
They're just thieves.
They're thieves. But the problem is with that is if you steal honey, there's obviously the issues of the disease management point of view.
Yeah. Okay.
Because of a few foul broods that we have, or two foul broods we have in Australia, and actually probably most of the world for that matter, is within the honey. Those spores are in the honey, and that's how it gets transferred.
Okay.
Mm.
All right, so just to recap, the Italians are the more placid, calmer ones, which are lighter. So, so when you see the lighter coloured ones, they should be a bit more calmer.
They should be, yes.
They should be, yeah.
Should be. And once again, we can have this hybridisation where you can go, okay, the Italian ones can be feisty. Now, weather plays – there's many variables there because weather plays a part in it, food, water even. You know, if it's a hot, dry day – And it's hard for them to collect water. They can be grumpy. Okay. So we can have that. Yeah. So we can have that. And there is actually a fourth strain, which is the Ligurian honeybee, which is from a descendant from the Italian, they're the ones that are on Kangaroo Island.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So they're Kangaroo Island, just off South Australia, is the only bee sanctuary in the world.
Oh, wow. Some very sexy tiger snakes on Kangaroo Island too.
Oh, there is. Yeah, there is too. That's right, there is.
KIs, love them.
That's right.
Yeah. So do most beekeepers keep a mix of strains or they just stick to one strain or?
Oh, the most predominant species that we have in Australia that's as a hobbyist beekeeper, even commercial beekeepers, is usually Italian genetics.
Okay.
Most of the time. And then once again, there are variables there for the listeners, but most often or not is the Italian genetics are the best ones because they work the hardest, very prolific, produce the most amount of honey and store most amount of honey, and they're calm and gentle.
Yeah, okay. Cool. All right. So speaking of beekeepers then, how do you actually raise queens?
Oh, that is a fantastic – so I dabbled in it. Now, every year I dabble and breed a few, and that was actually one of the reasons why I ducked up to Noosa over Easter. I went and saw a beekeeper, a bit of a hike actually. I went to Gatton just near Toowoomba.
Oh, wow. That is a hike.
Yeah, a bit of a hike, yeah. And so I went for a drive down there, a little hiker, and met my queen breeder, Daniel Curlis is his name, and saw his setup and obviously turned the trip into a tax deduction. Saw him. And so I get my queens from him because obviously, as you know, you're living in a beautiful part of the world, but it's because of the weather. So you can breed queens early up there, so a lot earlier than us in Victoria.
Okay.
So Yeah, so he breeds a really good queen. They're gentle as, like, we'll, you know, we'll open up hives. And one apiary had, it would have been in excess of 80 hives, with no protective clothing at all.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and opening, like, literally open up one hive, open them up, pulling frames out, next hive. And I was checking them out with them. No, we're just calm as. And that's important because it makes as a hobby or even as a, you know, as a commercial beekeeper, to have gentle bees that don't want to maul you, don't want to, you know, chew you up, so to speak, and sting you, it just makes it so much more enjoyable.
That's fascinating how you can pass that genetics on and, from the queen.
Oh, and some of the...
And breed them for that calmness or that placidness.
Oh, and it just goes, like, some of the traits that they're doing, so obviously as a disease resistant for cleaning, so a hygienic behaviour to actually clean, like, varroa mites, which we don't have in Australia, but there's these, and they've bought the genetics just recently, first time in over a decade they can import bees. That was last year, from Netherlands, had this particular hygienic behaviour. But there was one, just to recap,
so import bees. So we've always been able to export bees, is that correct?
Yeah, well, they did. There was a ban for a bit of time on exporting bees.
Yep.
So there was a little ban for a period of time. But, yeah, we do import them. Actually, it's one of those stupid laws. USA stopped the importation of bees from Australia.
Okay.
But so what we're doing is we're sending them to Canada, and then they were legit, so then they go Canada to America. So figure that anyway.
That's what the US does.
That's what the US does, exactly. It's like they're in embargo with Cuban cigars, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll get back to it.
What was the question? What was the
We're talking about queens. I was talking about genetics, calmness.
Oh, yeah, genetics. Yeah, yeah, yes, yeah. Sorry, yeah. So I was
imported. So, that's right. You imported from Netherlands.
From Holland. Yeah, so this particular strain. But there's a lady that breeds this strain of bees using Bendigo, and she's an absolute guru. And how's this? So she's bred this strain of bees. So when she's got a frame of honey and there's bees on it, if you tap that frame of honey, the bees will want to fall off.
Yeah.
As opposed to, and they don't get hurt, they just fall off into the main hive beneath them.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, bees that just want to hang on. And that was one particular trait she's bred. So now when you think about that, as a honey production, you know, bees don't get hurt, and it just makes it so much easier. So that's just one of many, many different traits.
How do you do that? That is just mind-blowing because, like, I breed, you know, bred reptiles for a long time, and you look at particular traits or colour forms in a clutch, and you pick out those with the best colour forms. But to actually... And you breed, you know, obviously that male with that female because of the colour form.
Yes.
But to select out of a hive of bees that have got that genetic trait that they want to fall down rather than hang on.
Yeah, that's correct. So let's say there's a trait there. Let's make one up. Let's say,
I guess all the progeny are obviously you know, offspring from that queen. So if that queen carries that genetic trait, then obviously it stands to reason that all the workers are going to have, or potentially have, that trait. Yeah. Okay.
That's right. So, and obviously that process is a lot quicker than, say, you know, breeding reptiles, which, you know, say snakes, pythons, you get one crack at it and that's it for the whole year.
Yeah.
You can actually line breed them, and then we can actually, you know, I don't do this. There's a few people in Australia do it, but you can actually do artificial insemination of a bee. Yeah, no, and it's actually, it's overseas they actually do it, and there's the equipment. You've got to use carbon dioxide to anaesthetize the queen.
Oh, okay, yep.
You pop the genitals of a ripe drone.
Yep.
You collect his sperm. He's got two peckers, so you collect the sperm, and then you inject it into the abdomen of the queen bee, and you can artificially inseminate it.
Now, my mind was going to horses and cows and visualizing.
Yeah, and so you can actually really control genetics with that. Now it's big. in, say, areas like I saw it in Ireland, Scotland, where they're just dealing with, you know, 250 days of crappy weather. So they can have bad matings with the queen. So they can actually artificially inseminate the queens and have really good productivity.
Okay.
So we do it here not for that reason, but for genetic traits.
Yeah, okay. So is that the main reason why people raise queens, is just that genetics, or?
Oh, yeah, no. So let's say hobbyist beekeeper had a hive of bees, say, for 2 years, and let's say they've become nasty. Yep. And that's because, unbeknownst to him or her, it swarmed, that queen has mated with a nasty drones from, I don't know, we'll say, say Collingwood. I go for the Pies, but anyway, I've got on my teeth. But anyway, so they mate with the nasty genetics. That queen gets, that hive gets nasty. So all of a sudden, you know, you open up the back door and you got bees that want to, you know, want to sting you.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So what you can then do is we can actually, in a positive way, we can manipulate that hive.
Yep.
So we can, you know, find that old queen, we can smack her on the head,
yep.
And then we introduce a new queen.
Yep.
And that new queen will breed out those bad genetics. So that's first thing for queen breeders. So that's obviously that. As a commercial aspect, a lot of the big commercial beekeepers, so honey producers, will actually do that every 12 months. Because they've got these young, vigorous queens that are just, you know, laying, you know, like she can lay up to 2,000 eggs per day. So you can imagine the more workers you've got, the more productivity, the more honey.
Yep.
So, and then the third one is, let's say something's happened, say that hobbyist beekeeper in Collingwood's accidentally, you know, killed that old queen, unbeknownst, and that queen is, that hive has now gone queenless. Then we can actually introduce a queen to actually save that colony. So that's kind of the three primary points as to breeding queens.
Okay, but wouldn't the hive automatically start to produce their own queens if the queen?
Oh yes, yeah, yeah, true.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
True.
Yep.
That is true. But let's say we're in, say, Noosa. We've got a hive in Noosa, but you've got something that's up there. There are down here, but they're not as many. Is the rainbow bee eater?
Yeah.
And I think that's the most beautiful of all birds.
Yep.
Beekeepers hate it. But let's say that queen, you know, she's gone on a maiden voyage and is going to mate with as many drones as possible. On her way back, she's preggers, you know, ready to rock and roll. Along comes a rainbow bee eater, goes bang.
Yeah. Yep.
Obviously, that hive can't produce another queen. It only gets one go at it.
Yeah, okay. So how many queens can you actually raise from a hive? And like, how did, because obviously the first emerged queen then smashes or kills, goes around and kills all the other new queens. How do they stop that from happening? And how many queens can these queen breeders produce from? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you can literally produce, you know, thousands and thousands, you know, weekly. But the problem is, though, is, let's say, so what you do, so say we've got some, we create a queenless hive, right? So we've got a hive that's queenless.
Yep.
We've got another hive that's got, say, that's particular genetics, nice and calm. So what we can then do is we can take out and use these cells. It's called grafting.
Yep.
So we get larvae that's 24 hours of age. So basically it's just hatched. And we get that little larvae, and it's kind of like a tiny little spatula. And you get that, and you put that into these little cups, and you can do, I think, 32 thereabouts on one frame. Well, obviously, variables there. And you put that into that queenless hive, and those bees go, oh, okay, we've got no queen. So they'll turn all those cells, you know, usually if you're a good queen breeder, you get about 95% success rate.
Yep.
So they'll turn in the cells. Then what you do is those cells, you can either put a cage on them. So if they do hatch, they can't obviously get, you know, that what queen, the first one out can't kill all the rest. Or that cells, and this is what I do, is I'll get a cell. So it's about 10, 12 days of age, and it's fully capped. And I'll get that queen cell, and I'll put that into a queenless hive. So it's like what we call a nucleus. So yep. It's consisting of anywhere from 4 to 6 frames, depending on the size box I'm using. And then when she hatches, they'll accept her most of the time. And then she'll go on a, she'll go mate. So usually within a week, 7 days, she'll go mate. So, and that's the control. You can only have so many of those mating nukes. Sometimes they're mini ones, but a traditional sort of full depth frame is the best size to use.
Okay.
There's this queen breeder. He's up in near Karoi in the sunny coast, and he actually breeds around 30,000 mated queen bees per year, and with an average of about $30 each. Now, wow. Do the maths on that. That's a good little one. Yeah, that's a good little money spin. Now, it's a lot of work, a lot of work, but it's, yeah. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Because I noticed when I used to, remember I told you in a previous episode, I used to collect scorpions and mail them to all the pet shops. And
yes.
One of the things was that, you know, and I looked up the legislation on it, you know, can I actually mail? Because, you know, it says, you know, you need to get a sign whether it's a dangerous goods or not.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, well, scorpions dangerous, classified as dangerous goods or what? And I remember my mail lady, she used to, my post office lady, she goes, Jay, I just don't want to know about it. Just do not tell me what's in here. And I remember looking at it and it says, well, hang on, if you can post bees then, and that was, there's actually legislation in Australia Post that you can actually legally post queen bees. And I'm thinking, well, if we can post queen bees, why can't I post scorpions?
Okay. And it's interesting, and I'll tell you the history of why we're allowed to do that. So back in the late 1800s in America, they used to breed queens and then send them by the postal service, but obviously that was via coach.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd send them to, you know, different parts of the states. And so it actually become this thing of these little parcels of queen bees. So, and that's actually stuck all around the world. So the rules are, we've just got a state that says, you know, live bees. We put holes in them. So, and that's express post.
Yeah.
We put holes in them and the queens are fine. They get these little, to paint a visual picture for the listeners, it's like a little, it can be wooden or a plastic little cage. And it's, it'd be sort of, what's that, 2.5 inches in the old language? What's that, sort of 6 centimeters thereabouts?
Yeah.
And it's got a little piece of candy in there. So it's like fondant, like a soft icing sugar mixture.
Oh, okay.
So the bees can feed on that.
Yep.
But the important fact is that queen's got to have a few escorts. So anywhere from 3 to 7 escorts. So they're basically young worker bees. They've got to be with her for the voyage. And okay. So, yeah. And so that's why we're allowed to actually send post them. Now, obviously, the rules are we can't send a WA because it's not a country. I think WA. I think that's it.
They're just backwards.
They're just different. Exactly. We can to Tassie. So Tassie we can, but a few certificates you need to. But what's interesting is Tassie can't send them to us.
Oh, okay.
And that's because they have this little, it's not even really a pest, but it's called the brawler fly. And it kind of looks it's different to varroa, but it's this little fly, like a little louse type thing that can be in the hives.
Okay.
So they've got it in Tasmania, and obviously it's not on the mainland. So,
Never heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, the brawler fly, B-R-A-U-L-A, brawler fly.
Okay. And they causing much havoc over there?
No. It's more of a visual thing. So there's no detrimental to the hives. It's not a concern. It's just that you've got these little lice type creatures, booting around the hives. And they're never like an infestated.
Yep.
The hives I've seen in Tassie, you know, I was excited to see one. You know what I mean? It's not like you can pick up a hive and it's full of them. So it's, and I think if I remember right, so don't quote me on this one, but they feed off the honey and pollen within the hives, but they've got a slow rate of gestation. So it's not like they, like say, African small hive beetle, which is on the mainland, that can really boom and that collapses hives.
Yeah.
And bad news, but it's, a little interesting fact.
Okay. So getting back to the queens, what have beekeepers got to do to prevent their hives from swarming? Obviously they don't want them to swarm because they're going to lose half their workers or a third of their workers, aren't they?
That's right, exactly.
So how do they stop that?
Well, so a lot, and this is probably, there's this invention called the flow hive, which now it was, and I'll use this as an example as to why they're more likely to swarm, and I'll sort of mention how to prevent it. But I'm seeing more and more swarms, and for the pesties listening, you're going to see more, because I tell you now, people keeping bees is as a hobbyist level is exponential. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah,
but a big part of this is, yeah, exactly. And the big part is this flow hive. So it's fundamentally, it's an invention from Byron Bay, Broken Heads, where it's these plastic frames and you can actually get the honey out nice and easy.
Yeah.
So because more, it's an easier way of keeping bees. But what happens, a lot of people have busy lives, you know, they're working and so forth. So, I love the romance of having bees. We'll have them in our backyard. And once again, not always, you know, with fly hives, but more often than not. And the bees will swarm, all right? And now they're more likely to swarm. How they should prevent that is doing these regular inspections.
Yep.
So the Apiary Code of Conduct in all the states could be twice per year. But come springtime, you really got to be on it. We're almost 1 week. And the biggest reason why they actually will swarm is usually an older queen or coupled with the lack of room. Because once the bees go, okay, we're full of honey, we're full of brood, we've got nowhere else to work, there's no other box been put on top of it, or the frames haven't been rotated out, and they go, okay, all right, what are we going to do? Natural reproduction is when they swarm. So to answer that question, what a hobbyist beekeeper should do is do those regular inspections in spring, give them room, make sure they've got plenty of room, and a great idea is to create their own split, so to create their own nucleus or nuclei, and actually do that to give them room. Then, now, there's a little bit of ethics here. It's a personal choice. But if you've got a queen that's 2 years of age, it's, you know, what you can do to help. It's a bit controversial, but in the beekeeping world, is you can find that old queen, knock on the head, introduce a new queen, and that'll minimize that swarming, because, you know, new queens don't want to swarm, generally speaking.
Yep. Okay. So if you've got queens developing, are they easy to pick amongst the brood comb?
Yeah. So it's like, think of it. So obviously that stage of metamorphosis, but the queens are about, you know, the queens themselves are about 30% bigger than a worker bee.
Okay.
But the actual queen cells look like, the easiest way to describe it is like a peanut. So you can imagine a peanut, you know, in a shell, actually hanging off a frame. It's not quite as big as that, but that's that shape that it's got. Now, sometimes if you've missed it, because sometimes what happens is people will see these peanut sort of swarm cells or queen cells, they'll kill them all, but unbeknownst to that beekeeper, they've already swarmed.
Oh, okay.
So then obviously then the hive's cactus.
Yeah.
Because there's no queen to actually step up. Yeah, exactly. So, so that's when sometimes what you can do in aspect is, you know, which is great, you know, for a beekeeper, if you want to, you know, get a new hive, because everyone wants bees, and I can't keep up the amount that I sort of produce. So what you could do is actually take out those couple of frames of bees, say, when I say maybe four frames, once again, depending on the area and so forth, and knock off all those queen cells bar one.
Yeah,
move that box somewhere, and then that'll create, you know, the that hive in there. So you get sort of two for the price of one.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and now once again, the variables there, because you can actually introduce, you know, buy a queen from a queen breeder,
and then
you know, you're actually guaranteed a certain genetics. But it is sometimes fun, you know, if someone's sort of getting right in the bees, to actually let them produce their own queen, because then you've got your local genetics.
Yep.
So you know, and there's good, you know, traits I'll have there.
Yeah. Here's a question for you. If you've got two hives and one of them's really pumping well and growing, but then you've got another hive that's struggling, can you actually take frames out of the one that's doing really well and just naturally insert them into the other hive? Can that work or not?
Yeah, no, you certainly can. Yeah, you certainly can. Yeah, so you can. The best thing is to shake off the bees. So if you've got that brood, what we call brood.
Yeah.
So that's when it's capped and you've got baby bees in there. So you can shake them off and add to the next hive. Is very important, though, once again, from a pest and disease measure point of view, you know, the specific disease, American foul brood, if you've got to be 100% certain that your bees are clean, because obviously you spread disease. So, you know, that's where variables.
So what you're basically doing is getting those young developed ones so they're going to emerge inside that new hive and
they'll prop it up.
That's going to be their new home. Okay, that makes
sense. That's right, and that'll prop them up. So you can sort of – but that's why someone keeping bees, good to have two hives.
Yep.
Because then you've got a little bit of insurance, because let's say a queen, something happens to the queen, you can actually, you know, manipulate those frames between the two hives.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Hey, all right, let's get back to dealing with bees as such.
Yeah.
When you collect the swarm and basically you sweep it into a box or whatever you're collecting, are you better off just – can you walk away with it pretty much then and there, or are you better off leaving it for the night until they all settle in? Or is there a time frame that you let the box sit there for before you walk off with it?
Yes. So what I do there, Jay, so the best thing is, say, okay, we've got a swarm hanging, a typical would be a rose bush.
Yeah.
Knock as many bees into that box with your frames, put the lid on top. I tell people, don't bother looking for the queen. You actually, a little thing I tell beekeepers, you hit guru status if you can see and find a queen.
Oh, no, she's
in a swarm. Yes. Yeah. So if you find a queen in a swarm, three swarms in a row, you hit guru status.
Okay, so three. All right.
Yeah, three in a row. So that's why a bit of a challenge I tell people. But yeah, so put them in the, and then ideally leave it there overnight.
Yeah.
Now, it's for me, I suppose, for my business, what I do is I can get 99.999% of them. Those last little couple will often, they'll abscond and then usually take off back to where they've come from, because obviously they're become sort of queenless, so they'll go back away. But obviously, once you get variables there, but usually you can get near on 100% if you do it straight away. But it is best, you know, leave it there overnight or at night time. They'll all go inside and then can move to the new place. But I should jump in and say as well, super important, there's a bit of shenanigans goes on with beekeepers. Not so much here in Australia, but it's obviously we've all heard of dodgy honey, particular brands, you know, got caught out mixing it with Australian honey and so forth. So, but there's a problem, I've got another problem, and there's a council called the ARBIC, Australian Honey Bee Industry Council, and they're working on preventing the importation of beeswax.
Okay.
Because now I saw this every year I see this happen. Let's say a beekeeper brings me up and says, I've got a swarm. Benny, they keep on leaving. They keep on absconding, coming out the hive. I've just caught this swarm. I've got a new box and got the frames. And what I'm seeing happening is some beeswax foundation, so it's on those frames.
Yeah.
It's got paraffin wax in it.
Ah.
And the bees don't like it.
Yeah. Mm. I actually listened to a podcast you did on this.
So there's a big problem. So now paraffin, that's a byproduct from petroleum.
Yeah.
The bees know, and they hate it. And it looks, it's, you know, paraffin beeswax is usually bright. It's this real vibrant orange, or, you know, really almost fluorescent yellow. And it doesn't have that real typical smell of, yeah. So there's, and as opposed to New Zealand, so New Zealand was smart. So they actually, the Kiwis, they banned all importation of honey and beeswax.
Okay.
And even just bee products, you know what I mean? So that prevents that from happening. We need to do it here in Australia.
Yeah, okay.
Because, it is a problem. It really is a problem. And the reason why it's a price point, it's, you know, to get a wholesale rate at the moment for beeswax, you're looking 20 to 25 a kilo for pure beeswax.
Yep.
Where, you know, stuff that's come from overseas that's been, you know, cut with paraffin, you know, it's under $10 a kilo.
Yeah, okay.
So you can see why people do it. But it's bad news.
Yeah, okay. All right, so once where was I going with this?
The swarm. So once the swarm, you mentioned obviously, best moving it at night time.
Yep.
So just lock them up and then move them to their new location.
Yep.
Or they can stay there. Let's say, the pest is listening's, getting into it. You could leave the swarm there sort of indefinitely. But when you do move it, make sure it's at night time.
Yeah.
And also, too, super, super important, lock them up because bees are a diurnal species.
Yep.
Now, a lot of people haven't, you know that word diurnal in the reptile trade, but it's obviously, opposite to nocturnal.
Yeah.
But bees at night time, you can have the most calmest Italian bees that are like cavoodles, and you upset them at night time, they're pissed. And often or not, if I'm going to remove a swarm at night time, I will charge an extra $100 to do it. Because they're nasty.
It's funny that, because everyone sort of says, you should treat them at night time because they're all in the hive, but they're going to be more aggressive at night time.
Oh, that's yes.
And that actually, that actually answers a question, not a question for me, but something that I noticed once. I've seen it a couple of times now where a client was complaining about finding dead bees on her porch every morning. On her porch every morning, there was dead bees everywhere. And so I've gone there and I'm looking around, there's no hive or such, on her porch. And why is that? And then I'm standing there and I'm looking around and I spotted this hive up in this hollow log, probably 30 meters away from the actual back porch, but facing it. And then it dawned on me, she has her porch light on every night. And they were perceiving that porch light as a threat. And so they were basically kamikaze in that porch light at nighttime and ending up dead on the that's what I put it down to.
Well, you're right, except no, they're thinking it's the sun.
Oh, okay.
Because the bees are, queens of the sun.
Yep.
And they navigate by the sun. Everything's, so they've seen this artificial light going, going WTF, what is this?
Yeah,
and
I thought they were perceiving it as a threat and they were just kamikaze and headbutting the actual.
No, it's unnatural.
Yeah. Okay.
Unnatural for it.
All right. So, when you find a swarm, apart from when they're in an easy location and you can just sort of shake the bush or just scoop them into the actual box, what about if you find them in a really difficult position where you just can't sort of knock them into it or you just can't sort of scrape them into it? Is there any tips or tricks you can get them to move into that box when you can't actually shake them into it?
Yes. So depending if they're, let's say they're in a position where they've huddled up in it. Let's say between some bricks, but it's not going to be they're more resting as opposed to setting up a camp.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So they're going to establish. So good little trick for everyone. What you can do is to help get them to move into a box. And it's, as I said, they're not going to want to stay there, but what you can use there is lemongrass oil.
Oh, really?
So put a couple of drops inside the hive. Like, don't go too much. People sometimes pour bucket loads in. You'd literally need 3 drops.
Yeah.
Now, lemongrass oil is a very similar smell to what's called the Nasonov pheromone. Now, that Nasonov pheromone is like an attractant. So there is a product called Swarm Commander, which they do make, but it's fundamentally just lemongrass oil.
Yeah,
and so that's like an attractant, and that will and can help. Just something as simple as that, and that's where hobbyist beekeepers. What I recommend for them to do if they're busy lives, working families and that type of thing, and you're not going to be home or you're going away, and it's potential swarming season, is create a couple of what we call swarm traps.
Yep.
So they're just beehives.
Yep.
With some frames in there and a couple of drops of lemon oil.
And
I've got a few dotted around Melbourne, and I've got one just near Blackburn Lake, at a doctor's place, just on top of his garage.
Yep.
And it's probably, as the crow flies, probably not even 50 meters from a hobbyist beekeeper, because I know he's got some bees in his backyard, and every year I get myself a box full of bees.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so a little trick for everyone. So you can do that. But if they're in, another thing you can do is starts getting a little bit complicated. So it depends how, you know, people sort of want to go down, but you can actually create a bee vacuum.
Yes.
So it's a purpose design. So there's specs on Google on how to make them, different ways to make them.
Yep.
But yeah, so that way you can actually gently vacuum into a design, purpose built hive.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I've seen those. Actually, I had an interesting one I'll tell you about. It was only a couple of weeks ago too. Client called up, swarm of bees hanging on the outside of a wall. So I go there, and then, yeah, you could see they're all sort of clumped on the outside of the wall more so than actually, you know, streaming in and out of the actual wall cavity. But there was just a cloud of bees just everywhere, and in particular, they were up in a, oh, I can't remember what it was, some tree just on the next door boundary line there, but they were just hovering around this tree everywhere. So I used, because they were outside the wall, I used the old soapy water trick and threw it over them, and they all just dropped to the ground dead. And I said to her, I said, look, I think, and this was only a couple of weeks ago, and I said, and it was when we had that real, we had a bit of a heat wave up here, and I said, I reckon the wall cavity's gotten too hot for them. And I said, and the queen's come out, and she's sitting in that clump that I've just hit with soapy water, and the rest of it all just workers just hovering around because they've all sort of exited the actual wall cavity. So that was all good. And I said, oh, look, hopefully all these workers will just sort of disappear. And I'm going to ask you a question about that shortly, actually. They'll just sort of bugger off now that the queen's gone. But anyway, a week later, she rings me back and she goes, they're still hanging around. She goes, not in the numbers they were, but they're still hanging around. So I go back there, and then there was nothing coming in and out of the wall, listened to the wall, nothing. I dusted the wall, no response, no nothing. But I could still see them sort of hovering around, you know, hovering around. And then I looked up in the tree and go, oh, there's just a little clump, only about the size of
grapefruit.
Grapefruit, yep. About the size of grapefruit, just hanging on the actual tree there. And so I go, there you go. And I looked, and sure enough, there was a little bit of honeycomb. Actually, they've actually started to construct there. So I got up and, soapy water again and just killed those off. My theory on it was, the wall cavity got too hot. The queen had exited because it was just too hot in there. And then she wasn't in that clump that I initially hit. She was up in the tree, and hence why they're all hovering around the tree. And then they've just decided to set up camp there. Am I correct in my thinking or not?
I was going to say 100%. But also I should mention,
it was just very weird. I hadn't seen it before.
Exactly. Yes. But what happens is, now, whether this is, you know, it's all very, you know, subjective, and there's different things about, obviously, with global warming and so forth, but we often, because it's the wrong time of year for bees to actually swarm.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So sometimes we can have these like, you know, these weird swarms. Now, for the listeners, you know, a swarm like that is not going to survive winter.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, to try and save a few bees as a pest and disease management point of view, trying to put them in a box to save them, it's not viable. So you actually did the right thing there by
Had a beekeeper once. I sent him a photo once of it.
Yep.
And he said, no, there's not enough numbers in there to be viable. He said, just kill them.
Right.
I've actually been told that before, yeah.
Exactly, that's right. In the bee world, we say euthanize.
Yep.
Okay. we euthanize is a nicer word. Yep. It's we never kill bees. We euthanize them.
Yeah.
And it is. Sometimes we can. And the problem is, and this has happened to people, where a little swarm like that, they've merged them with another colony, and obviously we can have issues with disease.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and that's, how do we know? Obviously, if you think they've absconded for whatever reason, it could have been too hot, it could have been many variables there, but often, you know, if there's a disease there, they'll actually take off.
So
that's why, done the right thing there.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Well, and sometimes we're going to do it. I think sometimes people, when we sort of, killing bees, oh, they don't do that. Now, obviously, we've got a nice big primary swarm that's, the size of a watermelon hanging from a rose bush that's just dropping a box. Yeah, different story. But sometimes, doing, euthanizing them is the right thing to do because, they're not going to survive and there's issues there and merging them and, you've got an old queen there or a defected queen because she may have issues. She may not be viable. Many issues there.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Hey, all right. So we've covered swarms, I think, pretty thoroughly. Anything in particular in swarms I think we've missed?
I think that was, that's absolutely, spot on. I think the swarms, that's awesome.
Cool. All right. So once they've set themselves up in a wall cavity, apart from the obvious killing, destroying method, and then obviously there's the cutout method, is there any other little methods you can use to get them out of the wall cavity?
I know. Good question, Jay. I've tried everything. I've tried, cat flea collars and, trying to get them a scar. I tried, trap outs, and that's another thing, trap outs is, I'm not a fan of them.
Yeah.
If there's, let's say there's bees in a, double brick wall of a house and to create this trap out. Now for the listeners, so what a trap out is basically we put the entrance of that brick wall where the bees are coming in and out of, we put a funnel and it's kind of a thing of like a one-way door.
Yep.
So the bees come out, we put a box next to it that's got some frames and brood from another hive. So we're forcing those bees to go into that box.
And some lemongrass oil?
Yeah, well, no, they won't. Once they're established, let's say they're hive's voice, they won't abscond it. Yeah. I mean, it's they're set up camp. That's their home. The problem is with the trap outs, in my opinion. And for listeners, shoot me through a message if you disagree or get in touch. But I don't like it because what you're basically doing is you're forcing that colony that's to wither away because that queen's going to stay right to the end, and it can actually, you're starving her out, and it's I don't like that. It's really, really, really don't like that way. But if you can get to them, cutting a hole. In some beekeepers, I don't do it, but some beekeepers are gurus at pulling bricks out.
Yep.
Don't know how they do it. Must be not the easiest thing to do, but or coming from the inside, plaster is the best thing. But also too, a little trick is you'd have one for termites using an infrared camera.
Yeah, I use a thermometer camera all the time to work out, pinpoint where they are.
Exactly. So then you can pinpoint it out. Do that. But sometimes if there's a safety aspect to it. Let's say it's a school, it's a double brick, and sometimes they have to be euthanized.
Yeah.
Because the safety of people is important because, not as many, but, people die every year in Australia from bee stings. Now, it's not many. It's, I think statistically, it's actually more. So I think combined bees and wasps than venomous snakes.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Definitely. 100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I should jump in though and say the biggest thing. Let's say you've got a bees in a double brick and you can't get them out and they're euthanized. All right. We'll accept that. I know it's hard for some people, but we'll accept it. But the biggest thing is stop them from coming back the following year.
Yeah.
Silicon, expand the foam, all that area, even if you've got to do the whole house, because I know, and all the pesties know, they're going to come back.
Yeah. Well, it's recurring revenue, mate.
Well, it is. But those bees should go. Now, if they can actually go somewhere else, and as we sort of touch base on the our first part, if they can sell them to beekeepers or work with them or somehow, it's kind of because there is plenty of work there for everyone. And as I said, so many people keeping bees.
100%.
I should mention too. I don't usually discuss this, but. But I can see by the year 2030, there's going to be too many people keeping bees.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's happened in London, happened in Paris. Yeah.
So what's been the repercussions of too many people keeping bees?
Well, too many people keeping bees, not enough food.
Yeah,
not
okay.
enough flowers.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. yeah. yeah. And there's a little here in Victoria, there's a little website you can actually, on the Department of Primary Industries, is you put in your postcode, let's say where I am, Nutter Wadding, 3131, and it'll tell you how many registered beekeepers are there in your suburb.
Yeah, wow.
And it's incredible.
Yep.
It's absolutely incredible. So now I'm part of that problem because I sell bees. So I'm going to put my hand up there. But I do, it's a lot of people getting bees because, obviously people go, which we haven't really talked about, Jay, but, everyone goes, oh, bees are in decline.
Yeah. Well, that's a big hot topic, that one, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And I tell you, listeners.
And a controversial one too.
And a controversial, I'll tell you now, they are not in decline in Australia.
Yeah.
Even overseas, we had colony collapses order in 2008. But here in Australia, we're the best, healthiest bees in the world.
Yeah.
Got perfect conditions, even for me in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, they are not in decline.
Yeah, it's a big controversial topic. One, that one, that's a podcast all on its own. That one,
yeah, it is, isn't it? It certainly is.
Yeah. Hey, just one quick question. I was going to ask you before.
When
we actually do euthanize an actual colony, and you still got those workers that are obviously being out foraging while you've actually done that treatment. I think you sort of touched on it before, but what do those workers actually do? I mean, I always say to the client, look, they'll hang around for, 24 hours, 48 hours, and then get bored and just fly off into the never-never.
Yes, yeah.
What do they actually do?
So while those workers, generally what will happen is if that colony has been euthanized, we can actually sort of, we'll discuss that as well and what the best way to do it as well. Because obviously different treatments and things. I'd be interested to hear what you do. But so what happens is those workers, when they're coming back home, they usually go into the nest, but they detect obviously there's an issue. Because if they're being euthanized, they make that horrendous sound. It's that roaring noise, which is very different to wasps. Wasps don't make a noise at all when they've been but they make that sad noise when they're being euthanized.
But they'll eventually
they recognize obviously their sisters are dying, and then they can take that 24 hours. So usually most of them will die inside that nest. You have those few fly out, but you're right, sometimes you get a few left on the outside. On the rare occasions that I've got to do it, and I save over 90% of them, probably 95%, but the product uses stardust.
Yeah.
And the reason why I use it, it's got a higher percentage of permethrin. Yep. Is that right, Jay? Permethrin? Yep. That's what I use.
Yeah, don't get me started. So, I was chatting to David Pretty today, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
nice guy. He's a
good guy. Yeah, from Sunju. So, obviously manufacture Stardust Pro. I won't get into chemistry. I think I touched on that with Mark Linton when you got that cis-trans ratio.
But it's an interesting – I just find that it will stop them because sometimes, other brands, that are running – I think it's 10 grams –
So 10 grams per kilo and 20 grams per kilo?
I think it's more.
It's the higher loading,
Exactly, and it'll humanely euthanize them quickly, and it at least stops them from coming back. If you used a Makita dust gun, 100% for 6 months, they won't come back. From my experience, it depends obviously how much product you use, but
the next season.
Until the next thing, and that's where people, if it does, you got to do it. Silicon, expander foam, stop them from coming back. It's super, super important.
Yeah. It's funny, an issue that I've experienced up here in Queensland is, and I never experienced it in Victoria, but I've had it twice now here in Queensland, and like the number of, treatments that I do for bees up here is minimal compared to, not even a tenth of what I used to do down Victoria, but I've actually had two hives now where a month later or so, all the honeycomb just melted and just started leaking in through the ceiling. And I never, ever had that in Victoria, never. But I've had it twice now here in Queensland. And I don't know if it's temperature related or it's something like hive beetle is a lot more prolific up here and basically
swarming them out.
Those secondary pests have actually just denatured the whole honeycomb, and it's just literally just leaked in through the actual ceiling through that mid-floor space. Both cases were like a mid-floor space that they'd actually set themselves up.
Yes, and I
treated it, and then a month later the clients had rang me and go, it's leaking honey through the ceiling.
That's where it's a real tricky one, and that goes back to that what I mentioned about trap outs. People are going to say, well, you still got the honey in there. You know what I mean? So often or not, using a product that's going to obviously prevent, for as long as possible. But those hive beetles. I've had it happen twice to me down here since 2008, and both times was on a west facing wall. So, which is rare for afternoons, that cooking sun in that summer. Yeah, so that happens. And that's where the best thing is to do is to actually get those bees, and I know it's pretty damaging to the house, but cutting them out and removing the honey, that's the best thing. But for the listeners, it's important. Sometimes that can't be done. It just can't be. So it's it's a tricky one, because sometimes people say, well, leave them there. That's another option as well, leaving the bees there. But the problem is, you've got, the numbers are going to get bigger, and it all it takes, gets stung.
The way I look at it is that if you leave it there, they're obviously going to, swarm again, season. Exactly. And then when they do swarm, they're actually going to, take up residence in a possum box or a native hollow log and compete with our native stuff as well. So there's that aspect that I sort of use. But I normally say to my clients, look, if they've only just recently sort of set themselves up within the sort of last sort of, couple of months, there's unlikely to be, any significant sort of stores in there. But if they've been there for more than a season or so, then obviously there's going to be some significant amount of stores in there, and there could be some further issues with those stores once I actually remove the bees. And obviously we strongly recommend once it all goes quiet to actually cut out those stores if possible and practical.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. If for me, with a client, on those rare occasions, got to be euthanized.
Yep.
I tell a client the blood's on their hands, not mine. That's what I tell them. So at least, well, probably makes me feel a bit better.
Yep.
But as I don't like doing it, but that's probably part of the reason I got myself a pest control license. And obviously wasps as well.
Yeah. All right, mate. We might wrap it up there. We've been well and truly over an hour again, and then we'll catch up again, and we'll get into other stinging insects, I reckon.
Oh, that'd be awesome, Jay. Yeah, no, I've got lots to talk about with wasps.
Yeah,
I
can see you were biting at the bit there to get into wasps there, and I thought, no, let's stick with bees. Otherwise, this podcast is going to be massive.
Oh, massive one, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we'll talk about wasps, because I just actually find them almost, in a weird way, I find them just as fascinating as bees.
I'm picking up that vibe from you.
Yeah, I don't know why. I just, we'll just touch base on it for the next two minutes. I'd love to do, and people are going to think, I'm weird and a whack job here, but I would love to set up some European wasp, Pula Germanica, in an observation hive. Like in some, they have to be all glass because they chew through everything, but how cool would that be to set them up in a little observation hive?
They would layer it up and paper it up so you wouldn't be able to observe them, I reckon.
Do you reckon? There was a guy, what's his name on YouTube? I think the Hornet King.
Yeah.
And he's done something similar. Now, you're right, they may do that, but if you sort of maybe had to blacked off a couple of bits of that glass, you could lift it up and create that viewing window. But, there's something about the wasps, European wasps, they're literally like an apex predator.
Yeah.
They really are. And I think that's just their whole social life with inside that colony is, and how they work is just, and how they sting. I got stung the other week, and boy, it hurts. It really hurts. Yeah, so I do find it fascinating.
I never realized how passionate you are about wasps, mate.
I know. I just find them With all insects, you know, I mean, well, all creatures, you know, and it's just, I just love them. But I know there's something, you know, something fascinating, even just those, the paper wasps, the little, Polistes humilius,
yeah.
You know, just those, you know, they're just fascinating on how they work, they forage, they work together. Yeah, they're just a little bit different than bees. You know, bees have got that sort of a certain vulnerability, you know, with them. But look at the European wasp. Is there a predator that actually will harm, hurt European wasps? Disease. Okay, is there a pest or a disease, a European wasps? No, I don't think there is.
No, just Stardust Pro.
A bit of a Stardust Pro. But yeah, so that's and interesting. So that's and I'm not, you know, absolutely adore bees. You know what I mean? I got the bee tattoo on me right okay. shoulder. Yep. I love me. I haven't got a wasp on yet, but I have to join the Bandidos or something. Get a wasp. they look angry. But yeah, anyway,
there's definitely a reputation when you mention the word, you know, wasps or hornets, or there's that instant sort of visual. Perception of temperament and the angry sort of thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, no, just find it. Even like termites, you know what I mean? With just as the structure and how they.
Social insects, mate.
Oh, social insects. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I'm a massive ant fan. I just love ants just because of that social aspect of it. And the thing what I love most about ants is that people aren't going to sue your ass over missing a few ants, whereas you miss termites, people tend to get a bit sensitive when it comes to their house and you.
Yes.
Yeah, when it comes to termites.
That's so true. Now I've got to just touch and base on, I know we could talk for hours and we'll wrap it up soon, but you know, with ants, right, here's a business opportunity for someone, right? So for someone listening, I can tell you're going to make squillions of money, right, is if someone could sell a proper, not like this kid's plastic type thing, but sell, and you could charge, I don't know, anywhere from $5 to $1,000 for a proper glass, snazzy looking ant farm.
I'll send you a couple of links, mate. There are some
Is anyone doing it properly, though? Like, properly for schools? There is?
Yes, yep. There's coming out. Wow, okay. Yeah, in Australia as well, that ant keeping has become extremely popular in the last 12 months, 2 years.
Has it?
There's a couple of Facebook pages now, Australian Ant Keeping, and there's a couple of websites called Australian Ant Keeping Depot. Most of the stuff they're sort of importing into Australia, but they're distributing here in Australia. And you get these little micro ones set up, so then you get these big ones and you can add on to them and keep joining on to them.
No way.
That's awesome. And you can buy ant colonies and that now. Except for Facebook. Facebook now sort of banned the sale of live insects, but you get onto the right people and you can get them. It's become a real fad, particularly with the real younger generation. I love it because it's sort of grooming that younger generation. I look at it and go, there's such a potential resource there for potential new pesties.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, because they've got that interest and that fascination with, you know, insects and particularly social insects.
That's right, exactly. And even the whole, you know, sort of mental health, mindfulness type aspect. You know, I could just see myself, having a nice big ant farm on my desk at my studio and just, like, watching these ants.
Yeah, I'll send you some links. I've got a couple of little ones here that I've had ants a few times, but I tend to... I don't know. I just get bored with them, forget about them, and then I come back and go, oh, bugger, they're all dead. I forgot the water.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. You sort of got to keep the moisture up to them, and it sort of gets away from you before you know it, and you go, oh, damn it.
Okay, so there's a bit of upkeep to them.
It's not big, but there is a little bit, yeah. You've got to keep, because obviously if you feed them well, and they'll keep sort of the colony will keep growing, and so you've got to keep adding on to it, and and if you don't keep the actual moisture up to them or the food up to them, then eventually the colony will actually collapse.
That's how fascinating is that? Mm. That'll be someone good for a podcast. Some like ant guru.
I'm gonna tee someone up for that. I want to do a series of these. You're covering bees, and you're going to cover wasps next episode, and then I'll get someone in for ants, and then I'm going to find a spider guru, which I've got someone in mind for that. But it's just, it gets a little bit tricky when I start talking, you know, I find a spider guru and I'm talking to pest control and we're talking about ways of killing spiders. They get a little bit emotional about it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. It is true. Yeah, good point.
But anyway, all right, mate, we better wrap this up. Mate, this episode, I reckon, has been absolutely jam-packed full of, you know, useful information. I know the first episode we went off on a few different tangents, and the last sort of 5 minutes we went off on a few different tangents. But I think for the guts of it, the majority of this podcast I felt was just, on point, lots of really, really helpful information. So, mate, I thank you for that.
No, no, thanks, Jay. No, I really appreciate you having me on. That was awesome. Thank you so much.
And all right, listeners, I hope you agree with me here, and we'll catch Ben on another episode of Pesty Profiles, talking all about wasp and other stinging insects.